Hello? All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thanks for coming out, everyone. I just have to make two quick announcements. If you're here for the co-curricular credit, make sure you swipe your one card on the card readers and sign up on campus mobility when you report your hours, and then we'll get you those hours. Also, we're going to end here approximately at 1:15. We're going to be out of here at 1:20. And if anybody wants to go, we're going to go over to Mazurik Rooms 305 and 306 for further question and answer sessions if you want to skip your lectures after this, okay?
Thank you. Hello, my name is Jim Bull. It is my pleasure to be the moderator today for the second of three sessions that we're having today, debating the question of human value and the existence of God. We have two speakers here today to present to you. Our first speaker is Dr. John Patrick. Dr. Patrick holds the degrees from the University of London and St. George's Hospital Medical School in London. He has done extensive research into the treatment of childhood nutritional deficiency and related diseases, holding appointments in Britain, the West Indies, and Canada. He lectures widely at universities in Britain, North America, the former Soviet Union, and Africa, working with various international agencies and with the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. In 2002, he retired from his lengthy position as Associate Professor, Clinical Nutrition, Departments of Biochemistry and Pediatrics at the University of Ottawa. He speaks frequently to university groups on moral issues and medicine and culture and the integration of faith and science. He's also president of Augustine College, a one-year post-high school institution. Our second speaker today is Dr. Peter Singer. Peter Singer was educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. He has taught at the University of Oxford, La Trobe University, and Monash University. And since 1999, he has been the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. From 2005 on, he has also held a part-time position of Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne and the Center for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. Among Dr. Singer's numerous publications are his books, Animal Liberation, Practical Ethics, The Expanding Circle, Should the Baby Live, with Helga Kuss, and How Are We to Live, and The Life You Can Save. Dr. Singer was the founding president of the International Association of Bioethics and founding co-editor of the journal Bioethics. Outside academic life, he is a co-founder and president of the Great Ape Project, an international effort to obtain basic rights for chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans. He is also president of Animal Rights International. So I want you to warmly welcome our guest today. I'd like to start with Dr. John Patrick.
Thank you. It's nice to be in Wayne State, I think. that remains to be seen with what Peter Singer does to me in the next little while. Let me ask you a question. First of all, how many medical students do we have here? Mainly medical students. How many first year? Mainly first year. But second year can think back to my question. You've been in medical school then just a few weeks, right? If I was to say to you that you have already decided that there are people in your class to whom you will never trust the care of a dog of yours, what would you say? Yeah, the answer is yes, isn't it? They're probably not at this lecture. So, there is in your class a group of people for whom you all already know that it would be better for patients and better for the profession of medicine if they weren't there. You never tell us, the faculty, because we wouldn't do anything about it. Because if we tried to do anything about it, they would hire lawyers and it would be too expensive. Some years further on in your career, those people will lose their licenses. It will be a complete shock to the faculty. There will be no data to document that this is going to happen. But none of you will be surprised. Now that's interesting, isn't it? So, since what we're talking about today is human worth and the future of medicine, that's what duties do we owe to other human beings. These are moral questions. And that little group that you don't trust, probably 20% at least of the class, are not so much immoral as amoral. They're selfish, aren't they? You will spend the next 4 or 5 years finding yourself with the worst on-call schedule while they get the best one, etc., etc. So, we can leave them out of the discussion that we're going to have this afternoon. They have yet to join it. Hopefully they will in due course. But let's move on a little further with the next question. Given that the rest of you are not in that group, do you trust your colleagues to practice ethical medicine in a way that you can accept if I remove from that discussion end-of-life issues, abortion, and sexuality? Now, will you trust one another at that level? Yeah, it's not very excitingly yes, 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 but there's no, 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 no's, you know. The answer's yes. Now, both sides consider themselves to be ethical, right? And yet there's total disagreement on the ethics of abortion, euthanasia, and sexuality. That is going to play a huge role in the future of medicine. Many years ago now, Alistair McIntyre wrote a very important book called After Virtue. It opens with a parable, sort of thing Jesus would do. He says, I want you to imagine a know-nothing government taking charge. I don't know about your country, but we've had plenty of experience of that. And they decide that all the problems in the world are due to science and scientists. So they solve the problem by blowing up the laboratories, burning the textbooks, and lynching the scientists. They discover, however, that they don't get a new green paradise out of this experience, but rather a dysfunctional society. So they decide to reintroduce science. So they have to poke around in the ruins and find the odd partial equation here, a bit of equipment there, and they teach it to the kids by rote. Just memorize it. Don't ask me what it means. You probably know a little bit about that, don't you? Of course, it's absolutely of no value because it's divorced from any overarching sense of what good and evil are, what morality is, how societies ought to live. Then says McIntyre, I'm not talking about science, though. I'm talking about morality. We have reached the point where we no longer agree on the nature of good and evil. And this was in the 70s. Of course, he's turned out to be right. And the question that these three lectures have, from my point of view, as an underpinning, is to give you an opportunity to think about how we can be civil to one another and work our way through these things. Each side, obviously, would like the other to join them. I doubt that that's going to happen. In the 19th century, people were sure that religion was going to die, but of course it's not dying, it's flourishing. Atheism has not grown very much, except in the universities. So they're out of touch with the general population. And of course, medicine has to deal with the proper population. I hope that when your ethics course comes along, you have a session in which you get somebody who is a doctor to come with their priest, imam, rabbi, and represent their community to you, so that you begin to understand how different cultural groups will want you to handle suffering, death, and apparent injustice. Where that has been done, it turns out to be the most appreciated session in the whole of the introductory course, because the rubber really hits the road. And of course, the structure of your class, if you did it, and it was like most schools in North America, it would not actually represent the belief structure of America. In Canada, we collect the data, although now it looks as though we might not, but up till now we've collected data on what people believe. And a friend of mine at McGill asks his class every year to identify their belief system, just anonymously. There's no name calling involved here, so that you can build a diagram of what the class looks like. And then he superimposes the Canadian data. And McGill, of course, probably the most cosmopolitan medical school on the continent, there's everything, including Zoroastrians, which you probably don't know what they are. An underrepresentation of Christians, because we're lazy. And we don't deserve to be in medical school to a large degree. We won't do the work. And we pay the price. But so David went round his faculty and found amongst his colleagues various groups. All of them. He couldn't find a Buddhist doctor, actually. And he could find a Buddhist doctor, but there wasn't a priest. And the students rotated round. It's very, very moving. He himself actually last year cheated a little bit in that he took his pastor's wife he passed that off fairly easily because she was an oncological nurse. And they talked about a real case of a woman who'd been just diagnosed with untreatable cancer, who had two children, 9, 11. And you're still sensitive at this stage. You're nice. We're in the process of turning you into cynics. It takes about 4 years. And then you enter recovery after residency. That's just the way it is. It ought not to be, but that is in fact the truth to a very large degree. Anyway, this nurse told the students about this woman and what could be done to help her deal with the fact that she was not going to be there for her children's growing up. And they were in tears. But then at the end she said, "I need to be honest with you. I am that woman." They didn't go to the next class. They wanted to know more. And of course, you are going to need to tell people that they're going to die. You're going to have colleagues who die. Medicine has a high suicide rate. I have lost 6 of my colleagues to suicide during my medical career. Make sure you have a support system in your life that will hold you accountable and get you to talk truthfully. It's going to be harder because we no longer have a moral consensus, because we no longer agree about issues of good and evil. Our definitions vary in the class. And I want to talk about that with you a little bit so that you can begin to think about what you can do to help one another. Now, the first thing to recognize is that when you say we have no moral consensus, it also means that we have no agreement as to what moral rationality looks like. The temptation is to call the other side irrational. That is wrong. You shouldn't do that. I normally illustrate this in Canada because it's very easy to do so by taking 2 examples of people that everybody in the audience knows. The leader of the abortion movement in Canada is a man called Dr. Henry Morgenthaler. All you need to know about Henry is that he's a compassionate man who lost all his family except one brother in Auschwitz. After that experience, he no longer believed in a God of love. I imagine you could share that likelihood. It would be hard. And so he came to be an existentialist. He believes that life has no meaning after death and that all you can do is increase the net happiness in the world now. And that's satisfying in itself, which is true. He's also honest about what he does. He says, "I snuff out human life." Now, when a woman, one of you say, gets pregnant when you don't want to, are you suffering? Of course you are. Anybody who doesn't see that needs a little remedial training. Of course you are. So Henry says, "What I see coming to my clinics are 2 people, 2 human beings that is, one of whom is currently self-aware and self-conscious and the other unself-conscious and unself-aware. When I have snuffed out the absurd, unself-conscious life, what has happened to the net happiness in the world? Well, it's increased. So you can be an ethical abortionist, I think, if and probably only if you believe that life has no meaning beyond death. If, on the other hand, you were to put Mother Teresa by the bed, so to speak, she would see 2 eternally significant lives, one of whom is about to jeopardize her soul. What is the rational thing to do if you believe that? It's the exact opposite. Both groups are rational. Give them their premise, they get to their conclusion. We don't agree. And that, of course, is the biggest problem for medicine. And what has happened to medicine in the last 50 years is making it much worse. And as yet, I don't know of a single textbook of internal medicine that talks about this. But when I began in medicine, I'm sorry to have to admit it was 50 years ago, so you might walk out on the grounds that I'm too old to have anything significant to say, and you're welcome. You can go to sleep too if you wish. But when I began at your stage, it was a very different world. We had a few antibiotics, no dialysis. the antihypertensive drugs were such that if you took them to be effective, you couldn't stand up or have sex. So most people chose to stand up and have sex and then die. In the end, our treatment was not very effective. And most of the patients who came to us came because of what God or nature had done to them. They were not responsible for their illness. Even smoking was not wrong. It was just beginning to be wrong. Doctors understood that it was causing cancer, but the general population hadn't got there yet. So they were not guilty for their diseases. Except, you know, there were a few that had done things like excessive alcohol and promiscuity who were responsible for the disease they'd got. Now, when you get to see patients, what proportion of your patients will be in front of you, at least in part, because of their own behavior? Any of the doctors in the audience, what would you say? In Detroit. It's got to be well over 70%, isn't it? Anybody disagree? No. Not if you're in family practice or general internal medicine. Think about it. If you're overweight, you can only get there by eating more than you need. That's not to say you don't have regulation problems, but at the end of the Second World War, there was no obesity in Britain and people were healthy. Because rationing made sure of that. I don't suppose that's going to be the American solution. You're not the sort of people who take to rationing. Sexually transmitted disease has gone through the roof. So that I know that in this audience, roughly 25% of the student women in this group, on average, will have evidence of having or currently having sexually transmitted disease. Was nothing like that when I went, because of course there was no effective contraceptive when I went to medical school. You can go on down the list. Drugs and alcohol are hugely greater than they were when I went to medical school. Now, is there... If you are sick and suffering, and those you say you love are suffering with you because of your behavior, what else must you deal with as well as your medical diagnosis? Come on, use the word. It's not one you like, but use it. Guilt, that's right. The only part of medicine where you'll find that word is in psychiatry, and it usually says guilt, feelings, evidence of depression. But it might be said guilt, feelings, evidence that you're human. We do feel guilty. It's a real phenomenon. Now, we had this earlier, and Peter Singer's approach is to get over it and do better things, and you'll forget it in a little while. Now, you in medicine will have to face slightly different responses to that, because do people forget the things they did? No. No. The world is as morally consequential as it is physically consequential. If you jump off a skyscraper, you will be dead when you hit the concrete. You all know that. But even with something as simple as lying, when you use lying to escape a situation, the real punishment is that you have become a liar. And if you go on doing it, shortly the lies will control you and not you the lies. And that happens across the board. If you have had sex before marriage, you have lost your virginity and you cannot have the marriage you might have had. Now, the sexologists know perfectly well that that very small percentage of people in North America who actually get to the altar virginal have, in fact, the best marriages. They have the longest sex for the longest time with the most satisfaction. They don't talk about it because it would put them out of business, wouldn't it? But it's true. And so you can go on down the list. And we all know these things. We were discussing this morning, and both sides of this discussion agree that you can know moral truth. It is something that all human beings know. Can any of you, for instance, stand up and defend the doing of gratuitous harm to an innocent human being? Well, it's very difficult. Of course, that's what abortion is, and the way that's been dealt with is by making a distinction, which will be discussed today, between human beings and human persons. When I went to medical school, there was no distinction. Now, you may even remember some biochemistry. Usually I say I taught biochemistry for years, that the only thing you'll remember at the end of the day is the Krebs cycle, You probably won't remember it correctly. Krebs didn't. He could work it out. And it doesn't matter anyway, because you'll never meet anybody without one, because they would be dead. The bits of biochemistry that matter are very obscure. The first time I came across a case of carnosine deficiency, I had no idea what it was. And the only clue was adipic acid in the urine. It took us 6 weeks to work it out. But that was a long while ago. You'll be taught about carnitine instead, and you'll forget about it. But that's okay. There are other people who will remember. But getting back to the main talk, nobody can defend the doing of gratuitous harm to an innocent human being, but you know that the only point at which you receive your unique identification number, 3.5 billion digits long, if you substitute 1, 2, 3, and 4 for A, C, T, and U, every one of you has a unique number. It's an interesting way to think about it, isn't it? And that's when you got it. So the only point at which you became a potential you as an individual was, in fact, a fertilization. And that was the way we thought up until abortion came along. And this trilemma, of course, is very difficult. How do you escape it? I think it was Annette Bayer who first suggested the way out, which is now amongst bioethicists the norm. A human person and a human being are not the same thing. Nobody can deny the biological definition of a human being, a living cell that is self-organized and, if left to itself, for as long as you've been left to yourself, would organize itself into a person of the appropriate sex, race, etc. That's the biological definition. But in order to do the gratuitous harm, in other words, to terminate its life, a distinction had to be made between human persons and human beings. There are many definitions, but the commonest ones have to do with function. You become a person when you're capable of having desires, can consider a future life. I usually use the terms when you're capable of relationship. I do it in part because it allows me a moment of relaxation in the talk, as I say to the women, don't look at the man next to you and wonder when he's going to make it, especially if he's your husband. But capable of relationship, you know, it's an incredible thought. And certainly many newborn babies are not able to do that, and some never will. And I have spent a large part of my life dealing with children who will never walk or talk or feed themselves, severe metabolic diseases and CP. Spent even more time with the malnourished children of the developing world, the 10-pound two-year-olds. And the other group I worked with was cystic fibrosis, which you may not see because we've already reduced its prevalence by 20% since we got the gene. Now, what we're doing is going to change the face of medicine and therefore the future of medicine. Let me illustrate what I mean in this particular area. In Canada, and I suspect it's the same here, only you have insurance people and we have the government, we are already targeting 20 or 30 diseases for elimination. When we get a new gene, does it immediately lead to treatment? No. Very rarely, in fact. We've known the genetic defect in sickle cell anemia for 40 years or more. One amino acid, can we do anything about it? No. But what can we do within weeks of getting that genetic information? We can have a test for in utero diagnosis. Now, we're using that test. Now, just to make it very personal, imagine that it will be computerized in due course, but imagine that you're on the committee looking at the genetic data of children in utero. And just for the sake of argument, let's say that you're looking at an in utero Mike Tyson and an in utero Helen Keller. I trust you all know who Helen Keller was. For those who don't, I know she was blind and deaf after birth, but it could have been genetic, and for the purposes of my illustration, let's assume that it was. There are plenty of syndromes that would fit. But which one of those two will pass the genetic testing? It's Mike Tyson, isn't it? Everything that we could measure about Mike Tyson was superb. Has he been a commendable citizen? No. What about Helen Keller? Her courage worked on a whole generation. If you've never read anything about her, go and read Walker Percy's account of Helen Keller in A Message in a Bottle. It's a beautiful account. And of Anne Sullivan, who gave her life to the service of Helen Keller and taught her to communicate. I call this the tyranny of the measurable. We will certainly get rid of, and can get rid of, the genes we can identify. We don't know what else we'll get rid of. I mean, we're already learning that it's not so simple, aren't we? Is your molecular biology turning out to be a simple subject? It is not. It's only going to get worse. I mean, I must confess, delighted when it turned out that rice had far more genes than we have. Because it helped with my initial cynical comment when I was told that I and a chimpanzee differ by only a few genes. The vast majority are shared. With rice too, come to that. I said, that seems to me to be a very good argument that genes are not a sufficient explanation for the difference. We have the same genes, but could you even begin to imagine a chimpanzee sequencing its own DNA? There are light years between us and the nearest animal. And our genes are different, multifunctional. All the talk now is in epigenetic factors, isn't it? I think it's now, I am not doing biochemistry anymore, but I do remember that they'd got up to about 30,000 proteins from a single gene. It's a long way from when I started in medical school, when it was Garrod with one gene, one disease. Cystic fibrosis was one disease when I was at your stage. Now it's 35, or was when I last looked. Your job is much more complex than mine. But what kind of world will it be that agrees to that kind of reductionism? What consequences will there be? I overheard a conversation in a CF clinic. One little nerd, and he was nerdy, was talking to an older boy who was cynical, and that disease can do that to you. A little nerd said, "My mum went to hospital last week in the morning. She wouldn't tell me why. She came home, she looked a bit off, but she said she was fine." And the other guy said, "Oh, she was going to have another baby like you, and she got rid of it." Don't those kids have enough to carry without adding that burden? In effect, saying you weren't wanted. And of course, you're all wanting to have equality, aren't you, as a major feature of your society. But of course, the moment we choose functional definitions of what it means to be human, we also choose inequality to be the criteria by which we do it, don't we? We can't avoid that. The only way that we could have equality, real equality, is by having the broadest possible definition of what it means to be human. And then asking the question of ourselves, what is our duty to these who have functional problems? I was stopped dead in my tracks by a nurse before I started working with CP kids, or as I started working with them. Because when I was doing pediatrics, we accepted that CP children were always thin and always cold. Well, I'd worked in the developing world, doubling the weight of 10-pound two-year-olds in 40 days. And I knew that when they arrived, they were cold. And when we fed them, they were warm. When they arrived, you could stick a needle in them and they wouldn't make any response. They were also depressed. When you fed them, they weren't. Perhaps the most beautiful clinical experience I had regularly at that stage was a woman coming with her baby. They were self-referrals from the ghettos, and saying, this little 10-pound, two-year-old scrap of humanity that she loved, said, "Can you save my baby? Because they tell me in West Kingston that you're the only place that might." I said, "Well, there's a good chance. But we will take about 40 to 50 days. And they would leave their children with us. They'd have to go back to their other children. And often didn't come for 3 or 4 weeks. And the unit was a bit impressive at the front door. They always came round the back and in through the garden window. And then they burst into tears because they couldn't see their baby. And I had the wonderful privilege every now and again, "Don't cry. and taking their baby to them, the baby recognized them before they recognized the baby. That's how much it had changed. Now, a utilitarian approach to malnourished children, they're not going to have in the long run a life that will be considered worthwhile from an American perspective. But they value their lives. One of the other turning points in my life was when a young man with cystic fibrosis who had helped me to do some experiments that led to something that you will see regularly when you go to the CF clinic. About 20% of the children in the CF clinic have a little button through which they're fed, which makes the last few years of their life much more endurable and gives them the energy to enjoy it. We put the first button into, well, the first permanent feeding tube into a CF child about over 20 years ago as an experimental procedure. One of the young men who helped me get to that point became a good friend. He did the experiments that didn't work. He didn't benefit, but he was willing to do it when he was 15. About this time of day, a few years ago now, I was called to his room. He was 19 at the time. When I got to his room, he was clearly dying. And I walked in and he said, "Good, I want to talk to you." Now, when you're dying of CF, you're lucky CO2 is going up and you just get uncomfortable. That's what was happening to him. His mother had been sitting there. Nothing had been said for a couple of hours. But when I got there, he said, "Good, sit down, I want to talk to you." And I sat down. He said, "It says in the Bible, if you ask anything in my name, I'll give it to you. I'm 19 and I'm dying and I don't want to. What do you say?" What would you do if a patient asked you that? I wanted a Peter Singer to answer that question, but he wasn't there to do it. I tried to escape, but he was up to that. And I had to work my way through the creed. Of course, he believed it all, but it wasn't helping. And of course, I was praying too, as you do under such circumstances. "Lord, I don't know what to say." And then into my head popped Annie Dillard. I discovered later it was a footnote. She wrote, "Oh yes, God will provide for all your needs, but do read the small print. He decides what your needs are." And I knew what to say. I'd already pointed out to Stephen that there were kids running on that ward who wouldn't have been walking but for his courage. This awful conversation, his mum had not said a word. But I'm sure she was taking a great interest. In fact, I know she was. And I said to him, "Look, you're misreading the text. You're asking God, expecting him to answer on your terms, but he will only give you what is right as judged by him and not by you. Both you and I know that you're going to die in a few hours unless there is a miracle. Can you also believe that that might be the best thing for you? That God is saying to you, 'Stephen, you have done all that I want. It's time to stop coughing and come home.'" And there was a very profound silence, and then he looked up and smiled and said, "Thank you. That helps. I think I can." And he died very peacefully a few hours later. It was very important for me because up to that point, I hadn't had a conversation like that for 20 years. And I had a huge guilt trip because I'd been practicing very bad medicine by not being seriously engaged with what patients believed, not treating them as human beings ought to be treated, with respect. His mother hadn't finished with me. She wrote me a note, which arrived 3 weeks later, which I still have somewhere, and she made it worse. She said it was ironic that you were not allowed to give Stephen food for his body, but thank God you were there when he needed food for his soul. We've been good friends ever since, obviously, but she helped me to change, and I realized I had to come and talk to medical students about these things. So that if you don't share the patient's belief, do what you do in the rest of medicine. Refer to somebody who does. Make sure that you have the spiritual dimension of your patients properly cared for, because it does help with guilt. It does set them free. Stephen died very peacefully. I could keep the next hour with that, but my time is gone. We'll have to wait for questions and let Peter give you the more erudite approach.
Thank you very much. Thank you, John, for that beginning. I'm not sure that what I'm going to say is more erudite, but it will certainly be different. I want to address the question about attitudes to human life, how we are thinking about human life now, and where I think we're going with that, and indeed where I think we ought to go with that. I want to start with a case that might surprise you because it's something that is not generally regarded as controversial. But I think if we're trying to understand changes in the conception of human life and human value and the importance of keeping human beings alive, we should think about it. And that case is the case of brain death. Because this is something that has been generally accepted throughout the world over the last 30 years, that when someone's brain has irreversibly ceased to function, they are dead. And that consensus is interesting because it marks a significant shift in the way we treat beings now from the way we would have treated them 30 or 40 years ago. Dr. Patrick was talking about changes over that period. But let's have a look at this one. If 30 or 40 years ago somebody had said, we are going to take a category of human beings and we are going to remove their hearts and donate those hearts to strangers so that the strangers can live, although of course the human being whose heart we have removed will die, no doubt everybody would have said, that's horrific. You can't do that. You're using a human being as a means to an end. But in fact, I think that is what has happened. And that is what we now all accept as a reasonable and proper and correct thing to do. And I share that view on this question. But what we have done is do this in a disguised way. We have done it by introducing a new definition of death. Back in 1968, the definition of death that you would find in every law dictionary or medical dictionary was the irreversible cessation of the heart and of the circulation of fluids in the body. By that standard, by that definition, someone who is now declared brain dead is still alive. Their heart is beating, their blood is circulating, their body is warm and soft to the touch. But we change the definition so that we can regard them as dead. Now, this was not a scientific discovery. It's not as if we suddenly discovered that beings who we had thought alive were in fact dead. There was no such discovery at all. What happened, if you want to go into the history of it, is that we developed respirators for keeping a certain category of patients alive who would have otherwise died quite rapidly with very severe brain injuries, head injuries. We also discovered then that we could transplant certain organs to save lives. Kidneys initially, but very important in this change, was the first attempt at a heart transplant done by Dr. Christian Barnard in South Africa. And it was when the news of that broke that the dean of the Harvard Medical School set up a committee, which has a long title about the ad hoc committee to consider the investigation of death, whatever, but at Princeton we call it the Harvard Brain Death Committee. Chaired by Professor Henry Beecher, and asked him to look at questions about the definition of death. And if you read the report of that committee, which you can find in the Journal of the American Medical Association for, if I remember rightly, 1969, you find that essentially they are saying that there are certain inconveniences and burdens in keeping patients alive on respirators. And there is also a cost in our inability to get organs that would be useful, life-saving indeed, for transplants. And that therefore, we should change the definition of death. And furthermore, that nobody who is in a certain state, where there are certain defined criteria, which roughly, though it's changed a bit, are the tests that you would do today to ascertain that brain death has occurred, that nobody in such a state ever recovers to a significant way. That is, nobody ever recovers consciousness or gets up and walks or anything like that. And that's true. But when you look at that report and you see what's going on, it clearly is a kind of cost-benefit decision that is being made. There are great costs to keeping these patients alive, and there is no real benefit because they don't get any better. In fact, at that time, they did die fairly soon anyway. The techniques for keeping them alive were not very good, and it was only usually a matter of days before they were dead in the traditional sense as well as in the new sense. But that's not relevant, of course. The fact that you're going to die in 3 or 4 days doesn't mean you're dead now. In fact, it implies that you're not dead now. And the fact that you'll never recover doesn't mean that you're dead now. Also implies that you're not dead now. And for that matter, the fact that you've only got machines keeping you alive doesn't mean that you're dead now. The machines are keeping you alive. So I don't think there's any good argument to suggest that these patients are actually dead. And it's a long discussion which we could go into, but I don't want to spend the whole of my half hour on brain death. And in fact, it's now possible to keep these patients alive much, much longer. Some people would say alive should here be in quotes, but I think they are actually physically alive. This has happened because we've had cases of women who've been declared brain dead, but they've been found to be pregnant. And someone has said, we should try to maintain the body so that the fetus, now let's say 3 months, can be delivered safely at 6 months, let's say, or six and a half months. So we've had patients who have been declared brain dead, whose bodies have been kept warm and whose hearts have been kept beating and whose blood has been kept circulating for 3 to 4 months. And I find it very hard to say that they're dead while all that's going on, and while a fetus is gestating and growing and developing in their body. I don't think that you can say that as a human organism, as the physical organism, these patients are dead. I think if you look honestly at the facts, you have to say that they are alive. Nevertheless, I want to suggest to you that even though these are living human beings, we are doing the right thing when we remove their hearts and donate them to others. We are doing the right thing because it is true that they have irreversibly lost consciousness, that they will never recover consciousness. And it is true that removing their organs can help to save the lives of others. And it's also true, of course, that there's a significant cost in resources to keeping them alive indefinitely, as long as we can, after they've irreversibly lost consciousness. If I'm right about this, and you can try and show me that I'm wrong if you wish, but if I'm right about this, we have an important distinction in terms of the value and the duty, the obligation to preserve life between the physical human organism and a being with consciousness or capable of ever having consciousness. Because I believe it's once you have irreversibly lost consciousness, then your life has no further value to you. It may have value to others, indeed. Just the fact that your heart could be donated to another will give your life value to others. But it may also be, independently of that, that your family have not yet accepted your death, are grieving about it, that they need a bit of time to adjust to that. So it may have value to others in that way as well. But I don't think it has value to you. And I don't think, therefore, you have a right, if you want to put it in terms of rights, I don't think you have a right to life beyond the point at which you've irreversibly lost consciousness. You could argue about if you had a living will and said, look, even if I do irreversibly lose consciousness, I want my body to be kept going as long as possible. To me, that would be a pretty weird desire. But if somebody did have that, you might want to respect that past desire. But assuming that that's not the case, I don't think your continued life is of value to you at that point. So let's take stock of this. If I'm right, the idea that human life is sacrosanct cannot be defended if by human life we mean the physical, living, human organism. Or let me put the challenge another way. If you want to defend the idea that human life is sacrosanct, meaning the physical, human organism, you ought to be picketing every hospital in the country that takes the hearts out of brain-dead patients and gives them to strangers because they're committing murder. Don't just go to the abortion clinics. It's going on here and everywhere else. And if you don't think you ought to do that, if you think there isn't something wrong with what we're doing when we take the hearts out of patients we've declared to be brain dead, then I think you need to start saying, okay, so what are the characteristics that give a human being a right to life? Or what are the characteristics that make it wrong to end a being's life? And what I've suggested, at a minimum, it may not be enough, but my argument suggests the minimum is a capacity for consciousness. Without consciousness, there is nothing special about human life. We're just an organism. There are many other organisms. We don't think their lives are all special. Indeed, without consciousness at all, I would say we exist at a plane that is below that of those non-human animals that are conscious, which includes birds and mammals, pigs, cats, dogs, chimpanzees, all of those anyway. So if we want to think about this, we might then start to ask another question, and that is, well, if consciousness is what makes human life valuable, is the floor anyway, the minimum that makes human life valuable, do we want to go any further? What else might there be? And there's a lot of different things that you can say here, and they are relevant to a lot of other cases. So I've mentioned already non-human animals, pigs and dogs and so on. Suppose you want to say human life in general, let's say you might have agreed with me about those that have irreversibly lost consciousness, but nevertheless, human life, the lives of all of us here in this room, you're all not only conscious, but you have a certain level of intelligence and cognitive ability. Otherwise, you must be very bored by what I'm saying because you're not taking it in. So, assuming that you have that, then you have a lot more than consciousness, and indeed you have more than the animals that I've mentioned. I agree with what Dr. Patrick said. We cannot imagine chimpanzees sequencing their own genome, and I cannot imagine chimpanzees listening to and understanding this lecture, let alone any other non-human animal. There may be non-human life forms elsewhere in the universe that could understand this, but we haven't met them as yet. So, if we want to say human life is special, I think the only way we can really defend that is by saying that it requires capacities above and beyond those of the pigs or the dogs or the chimpanzees, or whatever else. Now, we don't have to say this. We could say the life of any being with consciousness is of equal value. Obviously, you'd better be a vegetarian if you're going to say that, but I am a vegetarian, in fact, so I could say that. though I don't. It's not honestly what I believe. I do think that the tragedies that have occurred, let's say the tragedy that occurred in Haiti in the earthquake when something like 200,000 people were killed, that was a tragic day. And it's not dwarfed by the fact that on that day maybe 300 million chickens were killed, probably roughly, I don't have, you know, what, the number of chickens that are killed each day for human consumption. Because I do think that it's a different order of loss. But the kind of loss has to be something to do with the capacities of those human beings and the way in which they differ from and are superior to those of non-human animals. And I think this is now getting a bit more speculative, and I suggested to some of you who were here in the earlier session, I think it has something to do with our ability to exist over time. That is, the fact that I have a biographical life, not merely a biological one. I use words that a philosopher, James Rachels, used some time ago in a fine book. That is, I can think about what happened to me in the past, and I can have hopes and plans for what will happen to me in the future. I don't just live on a day-to-day basis. And that means that if I were killed against my will, I would have suffered a loss because of my inability to fulfill my plans and hopes for the future. Quite apart from the loss that my family would have experienced and others and so on. I would have suffered that kind of loss. That's different if we kill a chicken. A chicken doesn't have those plans and hopes for the future and doesn't lose that. Now, a chicken may still lose something. I'm not saying a chicken doesn't lose anything. It loses the rest of its life, which it, if it was not a factory farm chicken anyway, might have enjoyed. But it doesn't have that tragic element of being cut off before its time, before its work was complete, or anything of that sort. That's what I think makes the killing of normal human beings most serious, what most clearly differentiates it from the killing of non-human animals. Not the only things, and of course there's also the networks we have, the feelings of others, the love and care that we have for others. That's very relevant. But I'm trying to focus on the intrinsic questions, the questions of the value of the life as such. Now, if you agree with me that it's something like that, it may not be exactly that, but something like that, then I think that has a lot of significance for the kinds of cases that you are going to be coming up against in your medical careers, that some of you are having and some of you will be having. Because I think when we think about life and death questions, we need to consider these sorts of issues. So let me just mention some of them briefly in the time that I have left. I've already talked about brain death. Closest case to that is someone who is in a persistent vegetative state, has irreversibly lost consciousness, but is not brain dead because they have brain stem functions. Now, I think in these cases, obviously, that if we are clear about the diagnosis of irreversible loss of consciousness, there is no value to that human being in keeping that human being alive. Let's say, I will say, the person who existed has really gone. And lots of people recognize this. Lots of people say that. There was a famous Spanish soccer player a few years ago who was involved in an accident. Was in a persistent vegetative state for 10 years and then died. At that point, someone in the media asked his wife how she felt now that, I can't remember his name, so-and-so has died. She said, "I don't feel anything now. I lost him 10 years ago." We had a case in the United States that went to the Supreme Court of Nancy Beth Cruzan, a young woman from Missouri who was in an accident. Much the same thing happened. And her family felt the same. In fact, they put on her tombstone her birth date, the date at which she was in an accident, and the date at which she died. Three dates, not two. And they said, the date when she was in an accident, they said departed. and the date at which she died, they said at peace. So I think it's understandable that we should feel that. If we know someone and love them, if they are irreversibly comatose or irreversibly in a persistent vegetative state, if we can be sure, and only in some cases of PVS can we be sure, I should say. Not in all, but in some cases we can, especially now we've got ways of getting images of where blood flow in the brain is. If we can be sure, then I think there's no problem about withdrawing life support. We are deliberately ending the life of such a patient by doing that. I don't think we should disguise to ourselves that just because we're withdrawing life support, we're not deliberately ending life. But I think it's a justifiable decision that we make, because there is no further... Again, of course, we should be consulting with the family, but if the family are agreed with that, there's no further benefit in maintaining life for that person. Another case that I think is relatively easy is cases where people know that they're dying and are clear, they're mentally competent, are clear that they do not wish to go on living any further. They are then making a judgment that their life has no value to them. And I think if we respect human autonomy, we respect the capacity of people to make these decisions, and we're sure that this is a considered decision, maybe we've given them a few days after they first made that request to think about it, they repeat it, I think it's reasonable for us to act on that decision. I think that's their decision to make. It's not reasonable for us to say, no, you must go on living even if you don't want to, even if you think that the last month or two of your life are not going to be anything positive for you, even if you want to die in a certain condition, in a certain state, a certain amount of dignity. Nevertheless, you must go on living. I think that's wrong. And there are some countries, and even some states in this country, that have accepted that. In the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Luxembourg, you can make that decision and a doctor can actually give you a lethal injection on request to end your life. And that's been the case in the Netherlands at least for about for more than 20 years now. The doctors have been able to do that. And it has not, despite some predictions, generated some kind of horrific slippery slope where doctors are bumping off patients who want to go on living. There's no evidence at all that that's happening. In this country, it's been the case in Oregon for, I think, 8 or 9 years now, that if you tell your doctor you want to die, and you are the doctor and a second doctor think that you're going to die within 6 months, the doctor can give you a prescription and say, if you take this, you will die peacefully. And you can do that. Just a year and a... We're getting on for 2 years ago now, in November 2008, the neighbouring state, Washington, having observed what was happening in Oregon, said, this is good. We want it too. And you can do the same in Oregon as well now. So I think that those are good law reforms. I think they're things that are compatible with good health care. And I know Dr. Patrick said in this morning session he thought that if philosophers or lawyers advocated this, they should be the ones to do it. I think actually that the primary obligation of a physician is to act in the best interests of his or her patient. And if the patient, under these circumstances, reasonably judges that it's in his or her best interest to die sooner rather than later, and the physician in his or her conscience thinks that this is a reasonable and ethical thing to do, then it's the physician who has the expertise and generally the familiarity with the patient to bring that about much more competently than I could, I'm sure, and I think it's a proper last service that a physician can do for a patient. So I don't think those cases are really too difficult. The more difficult cases concern those who cannot consent. And of these I've written a good deal about infants. Infants born with severe disabilities where life and death decisions are made. Right now, on the basis, at least, of whether or not to continue life support. I teach at Princeton University in New Jersey, and the nearest hospital with a major neonatal intensive care unit is St. Peter's Hospital in New Brunswick. It's a Catholic hospital, but it's headed by a physician who is quite open about what he does. And I've taken, when I've had small classes interested in bioethics, I've sometimes taken them there. And he's taken them through the ward. Of course, they've marveled at these tiny, extremely premature babies, a baby who can fit on the palm of your hand. They've marveled at them with all these tubes and wires going on. They look around. And then we go and talk in a room. And on some occasions, the Catholic chaplain of the hospital has been there with the director of the unit. And he tells us quite openly that in some of these cases where there has been a massive hemorrhage in the brain, they've got scans to show the size of the damage, they talk to the family about whether they want life support to continue. And they say that the prospects of this child ever having relationships with others, or becoming, let alone becoming independent and caring for themselves, ever really getting out of bed, are minimal. And they ask the family what the family should do, what the family thinks that they should do. And if the family says, well, what are our choices? He says, we could discontinue life support. They say, what will happen? He says, well, your baby will die. Your baby will die within minutes or at most an hour or two. And they may ask questions about will the baby suffer, and they may be told, well, we can prevent the baby suffering during that process. And many of them will say then that's what we think he should do, and that's what he will do. And he doesn't see anything wrong with that, and nor does the chaplain of the hospital. And I agree with that too. But I perhaps differ with him and with the hospital chaplain on this point, and that is, I think that there isn't really a big ethical difference between what he's doing there and between taking active steps to end the life of a child. So suppose you had a child with the same degree of brain damage, the same brain hemorrhage, but it was no longer ventilator dependent. So you couldn't just turn off the ventilator and end its life. Does the fact that this baby can now breathe, is that morally relevant? Well, not really, because after all, if you kept the ventilator going on these babies where the decision was made to turn them off, those babies would probably, not certainly, but probably, have developed to the point at which they could breathe independently too. So the fact that the baby can breathe independently doesn't seem to be crucial. What is crucial is the judgment of future quality of life that you've made and the views of the parents as to whether they can cope with such a child, whether they think it's in the best interests of their child that this child should live, and so on. And that's a judgment which I think applies whether the infant can breathe or whether the infant cannot breathe. So although legally, of course, you can't do that in this country, not even in Oregon or Washington, but ethically I would think it's acceptable. And the only place I know where doctors have openly spoken about this and have not been threatened with prosecution is the Netherlands, where doctors at one particular hospital at Groningen published a paper about doing this in the case of, I think, 22 infants over 7 years. Not a large number, but they felt that this was in the best interests of these children. And again, I think that's a defensible practice. I've got 2 minutes, am I? Good. Okay, thank you. So let me just say one final thing about the issue that Dr. Patrick mentioned when he talked about abortion. Now, I agree with him that when we're talking about abortion, or if you like, even when we're talking about destroying embryos to obtain stem cells, we are talking about killing living human beings, living human organisms. I think it's a mistake for those who wish to defend abortion to deny that we're talking about human beings, that the fetus or the embryo is a living human being. Just as I said, the patient diagnosed as brain dead whose brain has irreversibly ceased to function, is also a living human being. So I don't think the fact that the fetus or embryo is a living human being is itself enough to say that it's wrong to end that being's life. It takes something more. I also said that, you know, beings who want to go on living and so on, that there's something much more serious about ending their life. That's obviously not the case with the embryo or the fetus. They're not capable of having those desires. They're not more cognitively developed than a dog, for example. But you might say there is a big difference in that they have the potential to have this consciousness. And that is true. They do have that potential. So the rightness or wrongness of abortion and of the destruction of embryos for stem cells depends on whether you think having that potential gives you a right to life or a claim to life. I don't think it does, and I don't think it does in the world in which we live, which is, as we know, a world of over 6 billion people going on for 7 billion, already significantly strained in terms of its environment, capacity to support more human beings, and give them a decent quality of life. If we were living in the same planet with 5 million human beings in it, I might think it's a good thing that we have more beings who can enjoy a rich and rewarding life, and that, at least other things being equal, people ought to bring as many children into existence as possible, and therefore, other things being equal, not in all cases, abortion is not a good thing to do. But just as I don't think we have an obligation to bring more people into existence in this world, because of the circumstances in which we are, and because neither the embryo nor fetus is a conscious being that wants to go on living, I don't think that it's wrong to end the life of those human beings. That's perhaps too short an answer, but given the time constraints, it's what I'm going to have to leave you with. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both Dr. Patrick and Dr. Singer for their presentations today. There will be a question and answer session, but however, due to the need for the use of this auditorium, it's actually going to be in the other building, room 305, 306. To get there, the best way is to walk across the second floor here to the walkway, and then you will magically appear on the third floor of the Student Center. So we'd like to have as many people who are